From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The crisis in Ukraine continues. Media reports about an alleged Russian ultimatum made to the Ukrainian armed forces in the Crimea are total nonsense, according to a statement from the Russian Defense Ministry, which said that no ultimatum had been made to Ukrainian forces. The Russian news agency Interfax reported that a spokesperson for the Russian Black Sea Fleet said, quote, "We have become accustomed to the daily accusations by the Ukrainian media of carrying out some sort of military actions against our Ukrainian colleagues. Those who want to pit us against each other in the Crimea won't succeed," closed quote. The newly appointed Ukrainian Defense Ministry claimed earlier Monday that the Russian Black Sea Fleet had delivered an ultimatum to the Ukrainian forces remaining on the Crimean Peninsula that, quote, "If they won't give up by 5 o'clock local time, a full-scale assault on the units of Ukrainian military in Crimea will begin," closed quote. But it appears that no fighting was necessary. The Ukrainian Air Force's 240th Tactical Aviation Brigade, based near Sevastopol, had already pledged allegiance to the authorities of Crimea, who do not recognize what it calls the coup government in Kiev. Also among those pledging allegiance to Crimea was Rear Admiral Denis Berezovsky, who was appointed by Kiev last week as the chief of the Ukrainian Navy, but swore to serve the people of Crimea on Monday. RT's Igor Piskunov reports from Simferopol in the Crimea.
Well, this is an Air Force base here in the Crimea. Among the aviation that they have are 45 MiG fighter jets and around 800 personnel members, and all of them have now swore their allegiance to the Crimean authorities, becoming an addition to other Crimean police, military, border guards, Navy, emergency services, who have all said that they will not fulfill what they call our illegal orders coming from the self-appointed government, self-appointed authorities in Kiev. It's not only about those who were in service before the uprising happened there in Kiev. Also now the former chief, commander-in-chief of Ukraine's Navy fleet, who was appointed by the new authorities there in Kiev after the uprising. He now says that the only old orders he'll take will come from also local authorities here in the Crimea.
I, Denis Berezovsky, swear allegiance to the people of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea and the hero city of Sevastopol. I swear to strictly comply with the orders of the Supreme Commander of Crimea and the commanders of military units approved by him, as well as with the requirements of military regulations. I swear to honorably perform my duty and protect the life and freedom of the residents of Crimea and the city of Sevastopol.
Meanwhile, it seems support within the military of the new authorities in Kiev is declining even in western parts of the country. There are reports that several special force brigades have refused to fulfill the orders to march on the Crimea. Here on the peninsula, most of the local military bases and arsenals are now under the complete control of local authorities. Those servicemen who refuse to pledge their allegiance to the Autonomous Republic of Crimea have either left the peninsula or resigned altogether. Now, currently, all the strategic facilities like airports, government buildings, even the streets of cities are patrolled by self-defense squads, and basically local authorities are currently building their own independent defense ministry and navy, while Kiev has been drafting reserve servicemen to bolster their military forces, but so far only around 1.5% of these reserves showed up.
According to a number of sources in Ukraine, the majority of troops in Crimea had already switched sides in favor of the local authorities. The United Nations Security Council was scheduled to meet Monday afternoon at Russia's request for the third meeting of the council since Friday, while UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was scheduled to meet with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Geneva, where Patrick Maigwa issued this report.
The United Nations is ready to offer any assistance which would lead to the peaceful resolution of the political crisis in Ukraine. Speaking in Geneva, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for the restoration of peace in Ukraine and urged Russia to refrain from any acts or rhetoric that could further escalate the situation. The Secretary General is scheduled to meet with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Geneva on Monday. Mr. Ban called for the full respect for and preservation of the independence, sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine.
We will discuss how the United Nations can work together with the Russian Federation and Ukraine authorities and OSCE, European Union and other partners to, first of all, de-escalate the situation and how we can promote the direct dialogue between authorities in Ukraine and also Russia. When I spoke to President Putin over the telephone last Saturday, I urged him to address this issue by engaging directly with Ukraine authorities. What would be the best way to, first of all, diffuse this tension? It is important that both sides should lower their temperature, refrain from making rhetorics, and engage in a dialogue.
But in a statement to the UN Human Rights Council, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov denied his country had invaded Ukraine by sending troops to the Crimean region. Mr. Lavrov said the troops will remain in the region until the normalization of the political situation in Ukraine.
Совет Федерации поддержал данное обращение, которое мы надеемся отрезвит радикалов.
This is a question of defending our citizens and compatriots and ensuring human rights, the right, especially the right to life. Those who are trying to interpret the situation as a sort of aggression and threatening sanctions and boycotts, these are the same partners of ours who consistently have encouraged their political forces to the ultimatum to refuse dialogue and ultimately have polarized Ukrainian society. We call upon them to show responsibility and to set aside geopolitical calculations and to put the interests of the Ukrainian people above all.
United Nations Deputy Secretary General Mr. Jan Eliasson is in Kiev for talks with the Ukrainian authorities. Patrick Maigua, United Nations, Geneva.
Russia's foreign ministry issued a statement Monday saying that China has expressed a broad overlap of views with Russia over the situation in Ukraine. We have this report from Press TV.
Russia says it is in broad agreement with China over the situation in Ukraine. The statement follows a telephone conversation between Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi. The Russian Foreign Ministry says the two leaders exchanged views on the situation in and around Ukraine and pledged to continue close contacts on the subject. Beijing and Moscow share similar stances on many international diplomatic issues.
The Russian Foreign Ministry said unacceptable threats delivered by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry regarding the situation in Crimea failed to take into account the violent power seizure in Kiev carried out by right-wing radicals. In a statement issued Monday, the ministry said Kerry's Cold War rhetoric would do nothing to punish what it called radical extremists who carried out the coup, but rather sought to put the focus on the Russian Federation. RT's Gayan Chichikayan reports.
Secretary Kerry threatened to isolate Russia economically and politically. He threatened asset freezes and visa bans. He said Russia may not remain in the G8. There were threats and there was criticism. Take a listen.
It's really 19th century behavior in the 21st century, and there is no way to start with. You just don't invade another country on phony pretext in order to assert your interests.
Well, the interviewer never asked him, what about Iraq? What about constant threats to use force coming from Washington? Even though Secretary Kerry has not received those questions, they certainly crossed the minds of those who saw the interview.
Since when does the United States government genuinely subscribe and defend the concepts of sovereignty and territorial integrity? They're certainly not doing that at the moment in Syria, where they're backing militants who have taken over border crossings in the north and in the east of the country. They certainly didn't do that when they attacked Libya. They certainly didn't do that when they invaded Iraq. They certainly didn't do that when they attacked Serbia over Kosovo and then later on recognized Kosovo's unilateral declaration of independence. The United States government merely pays lip service to sovereignty and territorial integrity. It picks and chooses.
During the Sunday interview, Secretary Kerry was also asked about Israel, about Prime Minister Netanyahu's upcoming visit, about the peace process. Of course, on those issues, we heard a very different Secretary Kerry, careful, diplomatic, calling for negotiations, no appeals to the UN Charter, not a word about Israel breaking international law and the U.S. supporting it. So you get a sense that the U.S. is appealing to the UN Charter when it's in its interests.
The well-documented presence of neo-Nazis at the head of the new Ukrainian government has all but escaped the attention of the Western media, where any reference at all to their presence seems coupled with a disclaimer that they are but a tiny minority. Journalist Wayne Madsen, a former intelligence analyst for the U.S. government, disagrees.
All we keep hearing is that the neo-Nazis represent a small portion of the Ukrainian government. Small portion, let's see, they've got the deputy prime ministership, they've got the National Security Council, they've got the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Environment, Ministry of Agriculture, and a prosecutor general. I do not think that that's a small a part of the Ukrainian government. That's some of the most key portfolios in the government.
Commentator Dmitry Babich, speaking with Voice of Russia Radio, said that the solution to the problem may well lie in pressure from the West, but on the new government in Kiev, not on Russia.
Well, the problem is that this new government has a very very visible list towards Western Ukraine and extremist nationalists. I would remind you that several members of the Svoboda Party, which is regarded as a neo-Nazi even by some of the mass media of the EU, they are members of this government. The head of the Security Council, Alexander Paruby, used to be the commander of Maidan, and in 1993 he founded the National Socialist Party of Ukraine together with his friend Oleg Tagnibok. And now he is the chairman of Ukraine's National Security Council. So no wonder that he declared universal mobilization just hours ago. And I think this is the problem. You know, these people are incompetent in running the economy, but they are very good at all sorts of mobilizations, at all sorts of ultimatums, calling to withstand pressure. So this may be one of the arguments against President Putin using, you know, this bargaining chip that he has, namely deploying the troops on the territory of Crimea outside the Russian bases. You know, the problem is that the new government in Kiev, or the nationalists inside this government, they're just waiting for this to show that they were right, that Russia wants to invade them, so the whole nation now has to consolidate around them.
Right. Dmitry, what do you think today are the various scenarios for the development of the situation, not only in Ukraine, but especially, particularly in Crimea? Do you see a potential for the splitting up of Ukraine? If so, into what sort of separate regions or parts? And do you see a potential for actually separating Crimea from Ukraine? Because, of course, there's several problems that need to be addressed, starting from the water supply problem and ending with... Right.
Well, I think that we should not misread Putin's actions. You know, his spokesman yesterday said, and also the deputy minister of foreign affairs, Grigory Karasin, reiterated this today, that the decision to make a full-scale deployment has not been taken. Actually, Putin had the right, according to Russian law, to deploy the troops without consent from the parliament. But he asked for that consent, and my reading of that action is that Putin wants to use the possibility of deployment as a bargaining chip in negotiations with the West. Now, a lot will depend on the West. If the West, you know, interprets Russia's actions as it did during the last 10 or 15 years, namely in the worst possible fashion, then there will be the worst of scenarios, and that means confrontation between Russia and the West with the unpredictable new Ukrainian government being a major instability factor. But I would prefer, and I think it's more possible, a more optimistic scenario. I hope that the West will finally make pressure on the government of Ukraine, and they will give some leeway to the eastern regions. They will allow the eastern regions to keep their governors. They will allow these regions to elect their own governors and local administrations, that they will allow schools to be operated in the way the Russian-speaking regions want. That would allow us to avoid conflict. And of course, I don't think that a real partition of Ukraine is possible, because the West will not recognize the Russian-speaking regions of Ukraine if they separate themselves from Ukraine. And certainly Russia doesn't want territorial gains. We don't want these formerly Russian but now Ukrainian lands. What Russia wants is to protect the rights of its citizens there, to protect the rights of the Russian speakers, and to prevent the Ukrainian scenario from becoming a reality in other parts of the former Soviet Union. It was clear that what happened in February was not a so-called people's revolution. It was a violent change of power, very undemocratic and very frightful for Russians and Ukrainians.
Right. Dmitry, you're speaking now, we're speaking now of, the possibility of Russia negotiating with the West, or the West negotiating with Ukraine. Is there no possibility of Russia directly negotiating with Ukraine? If that is a possibility, with whom? Who could they possibly? And would that lead to any resolutions that might,
Yes, I understand. Mm-hmm? I don't think that some people in the new Ukrainian government will talk to any kind of Russians. I mean, if you read the program of this Svoboda Party, if you read some of their documents, they say that Ukrainians are, I quote, culturally and anthropologically superior to Russians. So it's very hard to negotiate with these kind of people. But the problem is that the EU also disqualified itself as an intermediary in the inter-Ukrainian arguments, because the EU failed to guarantee the agreement on the separation of powers between Yanukovych and the opposition on the 21st of February. And what is even worse, these three foreign ministers who guaranteed this agreement and who didn't do anything to make these guarantees real, they didn't find a single critical word for the nationalist opposition that seized power afterwards. So my only hope is that the West realizes that Russia is not Syria, Russia is not Libya, Russia is not Iraq. Russia can't protect itself, so they have to take Russia seriously and start looking for a compromise. And looking for a compromise means pressuring the new Ukrainian government. The people in the new Ukrainian government are against compromises. They are intransigent and sometimes very stubborn in their mistakes. We have seen it during their violence around Maidan.
Right. Now, let's say that the very sort of the sharp conflict is sort of, we get over that. What's going to happen, going forward with this Ukrainian government, with the potentially permanently elected Ukrainian government? What's going to happen to Russian-Ukrainian relations?
Well, we have already seen it. A lot of the people who are now appointed the new governors or the new police chiefs, they were governors and police chiefs under the previous president, Viktor Yushchenko. And his rule was a disaster. Economically, Ukraine suffered tremendous losses. And even this terrible agreement on gas supplies from Russia was signed at the period when Yushchenko was formally in power and Tymoshenko was his prime minister. And the deal was so bad precisely because there was this conflict between Tymoshenko and Yushchenko. Let's not forget that. So these people can't run economy. They're very incompetent. They will certainly not be able to set Ukraine on the right track for an economic recovery. Sooner or later, if honest elections will be held, they will certainly lose these elections. But of course, in the nearest future, Russian-Ukrainian relations are going to be sort of frozen. We're going to see lots of tensions. We're going to hear lots of hysteric statements from Kiev. I would urge our Western listeners not to believe everything they hear from this new government, because they already speak about intervention, occupation, all sorts of hideous words. These words should not be taken at face value.
Andrei Klimov is a member of the Russian Senate and sits on the Foreign Affairs Committee. He spoke with RT's Sophie Shevardnadze about the situation in Ukraine.
Our task is to protect our compatriots, out of Russia and to protect our soldiers, our Marines staying in Crimea. This is according to the defense law of the Russian Federation, Article 10. This is the very situation of this law, according to this article. And certainly, to protect them, we have to have some flexibility to do that. And even if we cross a kind of red line somewhere in Crimea, it may be an outlaw case if we have no such kind of permission. Now we have such kind of permission, and we can protect our compatriots, our citizens of the Russian Federation, and our military troops inside Crimea.
But as of now, we're talking about permission, and I want to emphasize on the word permission, because
absolutely,
the troops haven't been deployed yet.
Absolutely.
And even the approval of the parliament doesn't mean that troops will be deployed
this is
at
only,
all.
This is only a kind of demonstration of the instrument, how we can do it, and this is the possibility, the official possibility, to realize that, to implement that instrument. But it is not the order for our troops there, of course not.
All right, but what we're seeing from the Western media is an outblown reaction saying that Russia is occupying Ukraine. Why do you think such an acute reaction to something that hasn't even happened yet?
Either they do not know the real things or they lie, and that's it.
What needs to happen for the Russian troops actually to be deployed in Crimea? Give me the scenario.
Well, I prefer not to speak about things which may be. I am a practical politician, so my task is to make a decision when we have the reality.
Right, but you have approved, the Senate has approved and given the right for the Russian troops to be deployed, so you must have a scenario.
Look, we have our commander-in-chief, Mr. President Putin, who can send such kind of orders to our forces directly. Parliamentarians, we have no such rights. So we know for sure that without our decision, it is not possible to protect in a proper way our military people and our civilians there. And that's it.
Brian Becker is with the Answer Coalition here in the U.S. He spoke with Liberation Radio's Ernesto Aguilar about the situation in Ukraine.
The Yevtushenko government has fled Kiev, and a new government has come into power. What we witnessed is essentially a classic coup d'etat. A democratically elected government had been destabilized by protests and by economic sabotage and by immense pressure from the most powerful Western imperialist countries, specifically the EU countries led by Germany and also by the United States. And as the Yevtushenko government agreed to have a new elections and a truce, so to speak, with the protests, it was at that moment that the security details were withdrawn from the presidential palace and Yevtushenko fled, because facing him was a mass movement led by the most right-wing fascist elements in the Ukraine, fascist elements who are in the parliament but more functioning as paramilitary organizations. Yevtushenko has left. The new government was created by a rump session of the Ukraine parliament. The Ukraine constitution says that a sitting president can be removed if parliament reviews impeachment articles, and after its review that a trial could be had and a president could be impeached, but it would have to be done by a three-quarters majority of the sitting parliament. In fact, what happened the other day is the right-wing parties, the semi-fascist and fascist organizations in the Ukraine, basically dissolved the existing parliament, held a rump session, and announced that Yevtushenko was no longer the president, and he fled. The United States media and the West European media are treating the protests in Kiev, which included armed struggle, people with bombs, fire bombs, and also weapons that were used to shoot police officers, they have been hailed as freedom fighters again. This crisis began in November when the EU countries in particular gave the Ukrainian government an ultimatum. They said, make a decision. Are you integrating into the EU along the terms of the EU, or are you going to stay with your historic economic and political relationship with Russia? And at that time, and starting at that time in November, and under that international pressure, the pro-European integration movement protests began in the streets of Kiev, And as I said, while they had many citizens who had undoubtedly legitimate grievances against the Yevtushenko government, the leadership was the Svoboda Party and other fascist forces who are strong in Ukraine and getting stronger throughout Europe. That's when this began. And during that entire time, and in spite of the fact that these were far-right fascist, semi-fascist forces in the leadership of the movement, the United States government, the Obama administration, the State Department, and the EU countries clearly were signaling day in and day out that they were 100% in support of the protests because they wanted to bring down the Yevtushenko government. Why? Ukraine is a big country. It's got 46 million people. It's got the second biggest military in Europe. And for the last 20 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, one Eastern European or Central European, formerly socialist country, after another, has been integrated into the EU and then subsequently integrated into NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, a military organization led by the United States. And what's in fact happening is all the former socialist bloc countries are being transformed or transitioned into a new Western imperialist, and particularly U.S. imperialist, sphere of influence right on Russia's border.
Why is the European Union and the United States as well so interested in seeing change in the Ukraine?
Well, the Ukraine is a highly important country. It was the breadbasket of the old Soviet Union. It's strategically located on the Crimea. It's, of course, on Russia's border. The United States, in particular, is trying to weaken or contain the reemergence of Russian power, not because they are ideologically opposed to the Putin government, which is, you know, a post-Soviet and thus a non-communist leadership, but they oppose Russia because they see Russia as a powerful entity that can check or challenge or blunt the attempted rising power of U.S. imperialism in that entire region. In the case of the EU countries have functioned as junior partners of U.S. imperialism. They're part of NATO. They were resuscitated after World War II. The German establishment in West Germany, which is now the dominant establishment in all of Germany, were essentially the old infrastructure of the Nazis, brought back to life in the late 1940s and early 1950s by the U.S. as part of the anti-Soviet campaign. And both of these entities, European capitalism functioning with its own interests, but still in a broad global sense as a junior partner to the Pentagon and U.S. imperialism, they are trying to grab up all of the formerly independent parts of Europe and see them as areas for exploitation. Eastern Europe and Central Europe, when they were part of the socialist bloc between 1945 and 1990, those were areas that imperialism could not just simply hold sway, use the land, labor, and resources for their own profits. They now see all of these entities as potentially lucrative markets where labor can be exploited, where natural resources, especially gas and oil in some of the areas, can be tapped. So it's a traditional sort of realm of imperialist expansionism. And as I said, in the case of the EU, they want to incorporate the Ukraine not as a German-style incorporation into the EU, but on the basis of the way Portugal and Greece and Ireland have functioned in the EU and Spain have functioned in the EU. In other words, they want to reduce the living standards of the Ukraine masses. They want to be able to use the wealth of the Ukraine as collateral for in return for getting bank credits from the IMF and the World Bank and German banks and U.S. banks. In other words, they plan to impose great austerity on the Ukrainian working population, which will be a source of additional profits for Western bankers. I think the struggle in the Ukraine is unresolved. Big sectors of the Ukrainian population, particularly in the eastern part of the country, in the south, they recognize the racist, fascist, anti-Semitic and xenophobic character of the new powers in Kiev. They are trying to rally together in opposition to the coup. I don't believe the Ukraine will be broken up, but we see that there is both geographic and ethnic as well as class divisions in the Ukraine. So this struggle is far from resolved.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.